Well, when last we spoke, you were talking about, well, with the Prelude to Axanar. That was, believe it or not, that was 2 years ago.
Oh, wow.
So what have you been up to, you know, in brief, since then?
Well, yeah, I'm still based in Los Angeles. I've been kind of doing some movies and web series here and there. I did a couple movies last year that were in theaters. One of them was the Henry Rollins movie, The Last Heist, which was with Mike Mendez, that was the director of Big Ass Spider. I got to work with him a little bit, and did another movie that just came out last month called Kill Ratio that was had Tom Hopper from Black Sails in it. And then I just finished up a little while ago a movie that's going to be out in theaters in the spring called Black Site Delta. And that was directed by a really great guy named Jesse Gustafson. He was up for a Student Academy Award for his short film Day 39.
Cool.
And really, I think, really a cool guy, great director. And I think it's going to be a very fun little action movie that comes out in the spring. So I'm excited for that one.
Awesome. Well, now we're here talking about your a particular project that is, I don't know, in my opinion, quite unique. And this is a project called, it's a virtual reality project. And then maybe you can explain to the listeners kind of exactly what this is all about.
Yes, so virtual reality is kind of growing by leaps and bounds, really. You know, when you look at the growth over the last couple of years. A little while ago, Doug Liman, who directed The Bourne Identity, Edge of Tomorrow, and Mr. and Mrs. Smith, he came up with the idea of trying to utilize virtual reality as a way to tell a narrative story. You know, virtual reality has been very successful with gaming, and it's been successful with, kind of what high-definition television used to be about 10 years ago, where you would see a lot of content that was just kind of showing off the tech but not really utilizing it in a dramatic way.
Right.
And Doug kind of looked at it and thought, well, what if we use this thing to tell a story, build a world around it? And so he started making a TV show called Invisible. And basically, it is one of the first, if not the first, I'm not 100% sure, television show that was filmed in complete virtual reality and is meant to be seen with a virtual reality headset. And so basically kind of started from scratch and created this series that was towards the beginning of 2016. And then one of the producers of the show, Julina Tatlock, approached Chris Lennertz to do the music. I had been experimenting a lot with some electronic music and had kind of been experimenting with a lot of different kinds of synthesizers and things like that. Very much to his credit and very much to his debt, he approached me and asked if I wanted to work on the series with him together and create the music for it. So we started writing the music in the summer of 2016, and basically for this show Invisible, which is a completely virtual reality immersive television show that you watch and have complete control over what you see.
Wow. Okay, so I have to ask, where do you start when you are writing music for something like this? Is it as, because I keep thinking of the interactivity and how that could change as you're watching. Is it like that, or am I is it just like scoring a TV show or a movie?
It's kind of a little from column A and a little from column B. The first thing that we thought of when we started working on it kind of was what you're describing is, well, how, you know, there's so many possibilities. We almost kind of overwhelmed ourselves with, well, it could be all of these things, and it could be, music that changes as the viewer turns their head, or, you know, when they look at something, then we have certain elements come in. At the end of the day, when you're telling a story, music kind of serves this very similar purpose. It's kind of like, you can make a car with all of the bells and whistles, but at the end of the day, a car still has to have an engine and it still has to have four wheels. And so we kind of scaled back a little bit once we sort of started from the outset and realized, you know, this is still a story about people, and it's about this family, and it's about this these people that get caught into this very dark and mysterious kind of set of circumstances. And really, we could make the music as simple or as complex as we needed it to be. And a lot of times we found that there's so much freedom you have watching the show. We tended to get a much stronger product by actually making the music just kind of follow the main story and kind of not drastically change what the music was supposed to do. You know, the spatial sensibility, I think, was a lot different. But in terms of, you know, the harmonic and melodic material, we still, you know, there's still a main theme and there's little motives for different elements of the stories and character through the series. But we tried to kind of keep it back to basics. And then we exploited the virtual reality more in the spatial element of taking the stems and then spreading them out in the mix. And, you know, the lead sound designer, this is a guy named Tim Gettimer. He was really instrumental in helping us kind of spatialize the music in a way that would make it interesting so that, you know, you could have synth pads behind the listener and keep strings in the front and things like that. But we also did something too where, you know, you have the score kind of fading out in this hospital in the first episode. And as it fades out into the scene behind you, you kind of start to hear a radio in the background. And it's really just source music. But if you turn to, like, approach the radio, that kind of becomes the most present piece of music in the scene. And then eventually the score kind of creeps back in and takes over. But you can still kind of hear the radio in the distance. So you do get some of that cross-pollination from time to time. But we tried to really keep it, you know, as straightforward as possible because we didn't want to overwhelm the viewer. And we thought it'd be better to have a strong, you know, musical heartbeat rather than try and do all kinds of different timed events and things like that.
Right. Now, it sounds like you're scoring a video game.
Almost. I want to say that some of the sound design does utilize very similar elements to a video game engine where things are cued and timed based on, you know, user interaction. And, you know, we didn't go as quite as deep as we would have done on a video game where you're developing, you know, many, many, many versions of the same cue that are supposed to have elements come in and out as they proceed. You know, the episodes are relatively short, you know, so what would happen is we found ourselves kind of just writing one cue that would go through the whole episode. You know, I'm pretty sure, it's been a while, but I think episode 3 and 4 are pretty much through composed. You know, the episode starts and ends and the music is always there. And so in those instances, we really just kind of treated it more like a traditional score of, okay, there's a main character, you know, what are they trying to accomplish? What's the story trying to say here? And kind of following that action. You know, which was surprising because we started thinking of it like a video game. And by the end, we kind of found ourselves just scoring the story and really trying to follow that and make sure that we were addressing all of that.
Okay. So now, were you able to utilize any kind of new technologies in this something that maybe hadn't, or are you just sticking to the tried and true?
This was more the tried and true. You know, Doug Lyman tells a great story about how, you know, making this series, you know, everyone from the screenwriter all the way to the final dubbing mixer was doing this for the first time. And everybody was kind of figuring out this process for themselves for the first time. And so the same was definitely true for music. And I think we sort of saw how we could accomplish this with what we knew was going to work, which was writing a theme, you know, creating a sound palette for the show and kind of letting the story tell us what we needed to do and really relying on that as opposed to kind of trying to reinvent the wheel. You know, there's been talk of a second season, and I hope we get to do it because I think everybody would kind of dive into it with a sort of a different sensibility that this time because we had the first season under our belt, and I think we kind of would be, okay, we've done it this way, but how can we keep evolving and maybe trying some new things with timing or user interaction on the music. You know, we did a lot with, in terms of music technology, you know, we did a lot of stuff with modular synthesizers, which has kind of had a big a boom in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And so one of the sounds that I created for the show was a contact microphone that's wired into my modular synthesizer. And when you would hit the side of the case and create these vibrations, the microphone would pick those up and then translate them into musical notes.
Wow.
And so it was used for the sort of the more horror elements of these people that can turn themselves invisible in the way that they sort of stalk humanity in a way and sort of mm-hmm. way they're this kind of very menacing presence in a sense, or some that choose to be menacing. And so when you hear them, there'd be this rumble, and instead of it being just like a pitchless sound, it would be this very metallic, sort of raspy metal sound that would kind of reverberate through the queue. And finding those kinds of things was really exciting, because you don't always get that kind of freedom on a project to kind of just say, yeah, I threw a bunch of patch cables into this modular synthesizer, and it's this really, very intense, awful sound. And most people would kind of run away from that. But on Invisible, they would hear it and they go, this is cool. And this actually helps create a soundscape that we're not used to hearing in a score. So that was stuff like that was really exciting. And it was fun to kind of use, that technology in a way to make kind of directly influence the music.
Okay. Now you mentioned modular synthesizers. So mm-hmm. Now what was the rationale behind your sound palette, other than just the use of synthesizers?
Well, the idea, was kind of because we didn't want to create an overwhelming soundscape, because there's going to be so much sound going on in a virtual reality world to begin with, where you can literally, it's a 360 perspective, both visually and with audio. And so the approach that Chris and I kind of decided on was going to be, what if we did a small chamber orchestra, which was mostly just basically strings. And then, that's kind of one extreme. When you think chamber ensemble, you think smaller, intimate kind of a thing. And then we mixed that with very harsh electronic sounds. And then how do we kind of marry them together? And that was kind of the decision that we made, was to sort of take a lot of processed sounds and things that were kind of being manipulated, and then mixing it with something very traditional, like strings. Mm-hmm. And we kind of messed around with that. We did about maybe 6 minutes, I think, of suites and different theme ideas and concepts. And those kind of carried us into, the show itself. And it kind of helped us inform, what the overall sound of the show was going to be. I think we knew strings were going to be important, because it's, it was a dramatic story with lots of different kinds of horror undertones, but also very dramatic and action undertones. We knew that strings would be important for that. And then I think there's something very cold and calculated about, the Ashlands, which are the family in the series that kind mm-hmm. of have these powers. And I think the synthesizers helped kind of push us in that direction and kind of call back to that sort of this very otherworldly, but very deliberate and sometimes evil kind of presence for the Ashlands.
Okay. So now you did a lot. You've collaborated obviously with Chris Leonards on this project. How did that work? Did he write a cue, or did you write an episode and he wrote an episode, or how does that work?
It was kind of an in tandem thing. We kind of both would sit down and talk about theme ideas and things, and certainly stylistic approaches. And then he would run with something and I would run with something, but regardless of who sort of did what, there was always a sort of a rendezvous between us after we had done something. So if I did something, I would bring it to him, and ultimately at the end of the day, I would kind of defer to him on final decisions, just because he was kind of the lead guy on it. But at the same time, he'd come to me a couple of things with some things with terms of the electronic design and things like that, and working with the synths. And so it definitely felt like a collaboration, in the sense of, we were always able to kind of bounce ideas off of each other. And then depending on, the episode or how much music was being needed to be written for that time, he would start something and I would finish it, or vice versa. And then basically, we would always make sure that we were both in on the spotting sessions as well. So we would sit down with the showrunners, and they would kind of talk us through the episode, and we'd kind of throw some ideas their way for approaches to the episode.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now you mentioned spotting. So this was actually, you actually had a chance to sit with the showrunners and talk about spotting. Did that work any differently than it would be for a television show or a movie?
Ironically, not really, because it's, when we would spot it, they would give us these QuickTime videos that were not VR. And basically it was the whole episode sort of flattened to fit into a 16:9 widescreen image. Mm-hmm. And so everybody looked like they had been folded in half, and you would watch the episode, and It took a little getting used to, but, you know, the thing that we'd kind of discovered is the deeper we got in the show, you know, even though we had the freedom to, you know, put on an Oculus or put on a Vive and look around and watch whatever we wanted, you know, the way that Doug Liman had directed it, he had done a very good job of still making it clear there was a story you needed to be paying attention to.
Right.
And so when we would spot it with Julina and the people at 30 Ninjas, you kind of just knew what you were supposed to be paying attention to. And they would kind of say like, yeah, this, you know, the music here should be addressing this thing. And they tended to want the music to help emphasize what the viewer was supposed to be watching. So in a lot of ways, you really did kind of come back to just approaching it as you would, ironically enough, like a television show or a movie, you know, where it's just cue starts here, cue ends here, and these are the things that the cue needs to accomplish by the time it's over. Necessarily a whole lot of talk of, or at least not after we got into the first couple of episodes, you know, of, well, if the person turns their head, why don't we trigger this layer of piano chords because they're looking at this thing? But really, whatever was important usually made its way to, you know, the quote-unquote front of the screen.
Okay. So now you mentioned that you'd actually used some of the Oculus and the, the other VR headset. I can't remember the name you mentioned.
Oh, the Vive.
Yeah, the Vive. So you actually got to use this technology. Did you do a lot of testing to you know, you mentioned the whole thing about the piano coming in if a person turns their head, that kind of thing. What kind of testing were you able to do before you actually started to get into your music?
They had come to the studio and sort of given us they brought an Oculus rig with them, and they had us watch the first, I think it was either the first episode or the first two episodes, I don't remember.
Okay.
And we would, you know, basically sit there and we'd watch the episode and on an Oculus and kind of get to experience the show, how it was going to be in the end. And then, you know, we basically were able to then take those QuickTime videos they'd given us where it was a flattened image and kind of then use what we had experienced when we were demoing the technology to take us into the writing and getting to experiment with, you know, when things would hit and how. But we were, you know, we definitely wanted to make sure that we didn't stray too far from the fact that at the end of the day, you know, you're always kind of confronted with these logistical questions,
right,
of, you know, how do we actually get the final product from our computers or from our sequencers, you know, to the mixer. And so, you know, I'd say we did less experimentation with the virtual reality side of it, more experimentation with, well, you know, are we going to give them 5.1 stems? Are we going to give them stereo stems? Are we going to give them, you know, 30 stems? Are we going to give them 10? You know, it was a much more, there's a lot of pragmatism involved, because as I'd said earlier, you know, we were all figuring out how to do this for the first time. You know, typically on a TV show or a movie, you know, you give them your 5.1 stems, deliver that to the dub mixer, they put them into the stage and they mix the show and that's the end of it. But with virtual reality, you know, you're talking about a completely different realm of technology, you know, where it's, you know, more than 5.1. I think it's either 7.1 or it might be a little higher than that. And it's,
right,
you know, a lot of things where the technology's kind of ahead of what you can do with music. You know, music has kind of fallen into this, it's either stereo or it's, you know, 5.0 or even 4.0, you know, you don't usually get in the center channel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's, there is a little bit of a catch up we had to play where we were deciding how we were going to try and adapt the music technology that we had into this world of virtual reality, which is very dense and very, you know, I think the Dolby Atmos is used a lot as well. And Atmos is,
right,
something that completely dwarfs what you can do to some extent with music. And there was a lot of that planning and experimentation had to be done. And I think that's why I would like to go back and do a second season, because I think there's more we could do with experimenting musically with, like you were saying, the idea of what elements come in when people look a certain way, or what can we do to shift the music as the perspective of the viewer changes. But at the same time, too, we have to make sure that whatever we do can scale to a variety of VR platforms, because there is no standard yet.
Right.
And You know, so someone who watches Invisible on an Oculus is going to have a much different experience from the person that watches it on Google Cardboard with their cell phone.
Wow.
And so we have to make sure that whatever we do, it can both sort of like a piece of origami. It can fold open and it can fold closed.
Cool. So I have to ask, is there going to be a soundtrack release for this?
There are no plans as of now. I assembled a little promotional album, which I put on my website, mm-hmm. and that's available for anyone that goes to my website as a shameless plug there. but as far as I know, there are no official plans to release a collection of the music. I don't think we've heard back about any real issues. If there's a second season, I think that would be probably as good a reason as any to put one out.
That'd be great. No, from what I've heard, it has a very dark feel to it. I was just thinking, wow, this would be great with just. Unfortunately, I personally haven't seen the series yet, because I don't own a VR headset. But I would like just listening to the music. I'm thinking, wow, this has got to be something that would be really cool to experience, and. I'm just really, really happy that they are bringing in known composers to work on this, and it's really great.
Yeah, I'm excited, and I think that it's something that could really be an interesting evolution of sorts, you know, for music in this kind of vocabulary, you know, where you're taking narrative music and putting it into this completely enveloping soundscape, and I think. You know, I'm hoping that a lot of other people keep kind of getting pulled into that world, especially as video games keep growing with VR, and hopefully there'll be more things like Invisible that, you know, are narrative stories, which is such a fertile ground for composers already, and that more composers kind of get pulled into this very exciting thing and just create more content, because I think that's really the thing that there needs to be more of right now, is just more content and more accessibility for people to kind of to watch this and get to experience it, because it feels familiar and it feels completely new at the same time, and that's usually the sign of a good technology for me.
Right. So, what was the most rewarding experience in working on Invisible?
I think it was kind of finally figuring out this kind of sound of merging. The chamber strings with the harder electronic tones, because they really don't go together. You know, if it was cooking, it would be like, you know, mixing, you know, eggs and chocolate. Like it's kind of when, you know, in very raw states. And I think that was really rewarding to kind of take really refined, traditional, accessible sounds like strings, and then taking these really harsh, ugly electronic sounds, and then finding out how we could sort of merge them together and creating this this kind of, like you said, a very dark, atmospheric kind of score that also is a little, it's not quite, you know, it's not as heavy as something that would be a full orchestra, and it's not as edgy as something that would be completely electronic. And I think kind of finding that balance was really exciting, and Chris and I were both really happy when we did. I think it kind of, you know, it made a lot of the experimentation worthwhile in terms of being able to, you know, sit there with a modular synth for 2 hours and fiddling with knobs and cables, and then all of a sudden finding this sound and it going, oh my God, like that's it. And then mixing that with something that, you know, the pulsating strings and the very quiet legato lines. It's just finding that touch for the show was really exciting, and I hope we get to do more with it, either with Invisible or with another project.
Okay, so now where can we find that soundtrack or the small promotional on your website?
Yeah, so it's just alexanderbornstein.com/invisible-ost. And then if you want to watch Invisible the series, you can do so on any virtual reality platform. And then you can also watch the series on your web browser by going to the Samsung virtual reality website.
Okay. That's awesome. Well, thanks, Alex. I really appreciate this, because this is something very unique. And I always like to do something special for my kind of anniversary shows. And this is 850. So I thought this would be really cool to bring in as something that is unique. And I hope that that this turns into something very lucrative for you, because it sounds like something that it would be really cool to be on the leading edge of.
Yeah, fingers crossed. You know, this could be the start of something for the whole technology. And you know, definitely, it was really awesome. You know, getting to kind of share it with people and getting to talk about it with you on your show. And congratulations, by the way, on so many shows. That's fantastic.
Well, again, I really appreciate the time you've given me here. And again, I hope that your career continues on the incredible path that it has been going.
Thank you, Rob. Yeah, I appreciate always getting asked to be on the show, and thanks for having me on as always. And it's cool to be able to kind of spread the word about this stuff with you guys. So thank you very much.